Since 1972, Braun Industries has been a custom ambulance manufacturer focused on safety, quality, and innovation. Each Braun module is unique well beyond the chassis it's built on. With 6 ambulance models, limitless features, and all customizable options, let Braun assist you in designing the perfect custom ambulance to suit your needs. Learn more at www.braunambulances.com.
Is your fire department prepared to face challenges like the turbulent economy, recruiting and retention, and funding? Level up and get the training and strategies you need on the issues that matter most at WAVE 2023, featuring ESO Training Academy on April 11th through the 14th, 2023, in Austin, Texas. ESO, a leading provider of fire RMS and EPCR software, brings together national industry leaders, quality training, and experienced fire and EMS professionals for a unique conference experience that will inspire you to drive change within your organization and prepare for 2023's challenges. For a limited time, our listeners can use the discount code FIRETRUCK to save $100 on a full 4-day conference pass. Don't miss this opportunity to learn from some of the nation's top experts in emergency services. Visit ESOWAVE.com to register today. That's ESOWAVE.com. See you in Austin on April 11th through the 14th, 2023.
This podcast is brought to you by Flex 7 from Tenkata Protective Fabrics. Like a trusted turnout jacket you've had for years, Flex 7 outer shell fabric delivers a perfectly broken-in feel on the very first wear. Flexible, comfortable, empowered with the strength of enforced technology, Flex 7 outer shell fabric is made to move. To learn more, visit TenkataFabrics.com/Flex7. Flex 7, powered by Enforce technology, only from Tenkata Protective Fabrics.
Welcome to another episode of the First Two Battalion Chiefs. And tonight I'm honored to have with me, joining me is Tony Carroll, retired from Washington, D.C. Tony, there?
Yes, sir. I'm here, ready for action.
Hey, Tony. Hey, thanks for coming on tonight. Appreciate it. Do you like that classical music? I feel like it gives us a little kind of a air of like sophistication, you know? Before the insanity.
I'm surprised that came from Chief Sheridan. I never thought of you to be the classical guy.
And I'm not. But anyway, so Tony, why don't you just introduce yourself instead of me trying to figure this out? I know you were in Washington, and I know you retired, and now you're somewhere in Virginia. So why don't you tell us a little bit about you, where you were and where you are now?
Yes. I started out as a volunteer back, 40 years ago, and in my hometown here in Northern Virginia. That took me to Alexandria, Virginia. I worked there for a couple years. Then I got onto the D.C. Fire Department, where I had an amazing career there, 29 years, and finally retired as a battalion chief. In the 2nd Battalion, which goes from Capitol Hill out to like RFK Stadium. And farther east all the way to Maryland. It's a really diverse battalion with a bunch of good guys and go-getters in there. That was fun. And then a friend of mine was chief in a small department, big county, very rural in the middle of Virginia. And they were starting to do shift commanders there. So me and another friend, I went down and talked to him, and he was like, yeah, put in. You know, it's a growing place. So I did that. It'll be 2 years in May, around Memorial Day of May is when it'll be my two-year anniversary there. Again, small apartment. We just added a few more people, so we're up to like 72 in the career department. It's a combination, so there's volunteer departments down there. Very rural. It's about a 520 square mile county with 40,000 people. So it's kind of cool. You know, I get to see a different side of firefighting and a lot of EMS work. So that's what I'm doing now. It's pretty cool.
Very nice. Yeah, that sounds like the town I live in. I live up in Putnam County, up in a little town called Mayapack, and it's the same thing. We have about 40,000 people. It's about the same size, but we're strictly volunteer. So who knows? Maybe when my day comes to retire, maybe I'll go and see what's happening with the volunteer fire department. So anyway, let me ask you, how long were you a battalion chief in D.C.?
About 4 years.
Okay.
I did a couple different battalions. My first assignment was 1st Battalion, which is primarily like residential buildings. There's some row houses, a lot of single families. It kind of borders northeast of like what you would think of as like the D.C. part. And then I went to the training academy for 18 months or so, and then back out to the field. So yeah, I think it was 4 or 5 years as a battalion chief.
Gotcha. So yeah, all right. So anyway, what I'm trying to do now with this new podcast is I'm trying to bring it back a little bit more to the roots, you know, like what it is, the first two battalion chief. And I want to make it more like, instead of being so scripted, I just want it to be more of a kind of a spontaneous discussion like you'd have in a kitchen, you know. And so anyway, I think I first met you on Phil Joe's, we had that little session we were doing, that training session on the he'd put up a scenario, and then a bunch of us would bring our own experience into that, which I thought was really cool. It was at some point, at one point, I think, a dozen of us at some point from all over the country. You know, so I think I know who you were, but I mean, that's the first time I actually ever really met you. So anyway, you know what I wanted to talk about just to start the conversation is I had a little incident about 2 weeks ago. I wound up going to a multiple alarm. They had a serious fire during the night. I'd say it came in around midnight in the borough, the neighborhood that I grew up in, and we had a wind-driven event. I wasn't at the fire, but one of my truck companies went, and we've had a few of them lately. We've had some wind-driven events, and what's kind of, kind of disconcerting is that we always associate wind-driven fires with high-rises, right? And I know, I'm sure in D.C. you've had your share of high-rises, I would imagine, like project-type buildings we call them. And we always associate wind-driven fires with, like high-rises, like 10, 15, 20-story buildings, and never think about it so much with two-story private dwellings or, anything, or tax for anything. Because any place where you have wind, you have the potential for a wind-driven event. And this was one of those things where it started in a car. Then it exposed the dwelling and got into the windows, and the wind just took it. And one of the engine companies came in, and they tried to hit it head-on. And I think one or two of them went to the burn center, and a few of them jumped out windows. One of the guys that jumped out the windows was a lieutenant who was a firefighter in one of my truck companies. So I don't know, maybe just get the ball rolling. We could talk a little bit about wind-driven fires. I think that from what I remember, that fire in Cherry Road, was that in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, and that was not a wind-impacted fire. It was just fire behavior, right? Basement with uncontrolled, with some ventilation, some uncoordinated ventilation and with hose lines that, that was some communications issues, but no, it wasn't wind impacted. And, I think that's one of the things that, our high rises in D.C. are capped at a certain height, right? So probably a 13, 14-story building would be the tallest thing that we had in the city. And I can't really remember a whole lot of, of that wind that you kind of characterize, being around high, the really tall high rises like you guys had. It definitely happened. There was definitely some incidents, where I can think of some that came from the, outside-in kind of fires that were impacted. But it's tough to really put a finger on, some of the ones that, again, you guys got a lot of remarkable incidents there, like Vandalia Avenue. Those are some crazy wind-driven fires that I can't really relate to.
Yeah. Well, I've been involved in a few, and one in particular, I was a lieutenant, and someone did something. All it takes at a fire is just one firefighter to do something, without thinking or without communicating. And I've had a few of them, but this one in particular, this firefighter, and I heard the glass break, and I was like, all I could say was, "Oh man," and I didn't say it like that, but and only by the grace of God that the wind was blowing from the other window, it blew behind my back and into the room and out, and the room just lit up like an inferno. And had that gone the other way, the six of us would have been instantly roasted, because the wind was just came whipping through there. I don't know. I'm thinking now, after these two events, I'm working, and the first thing we look at when we have to change the tools is we get a weather advisory. And one of the things that we get informed about is the actual wind speed, or the expected wind speeds. Because I think now, after these last few events that we just had, we have to disassociate now, thinking that these wind-driven events are only for high-rise. They could turn up anywhere. We had one a few years ago up in Throgs Neck, and I wasn't working. I just happened to come in. I relieved the guy that night. And the fire was in a private dwelling, and it was a total wind-driven event, in a two-story private dwelling in Throgs Neck. So I think, when we talk about doing a size-up, when we talk about cold as well, that W is weather. I think we should also say wind as part of that weather. How do you feel about that, Tony?
I tell you what I really took away from Steve Schaefer from Boston, right? He's doing that thing with us with Joe's. And I talked to him. I did a Mayday Monday interview with him about the Back Bay fire that the anniversary was just the other day.
Recently.
They lost the two guys, right? And he talked about how he was at, they had a staff meeting in town earlier that day. And apparently wherever they were, it was like an older building. And he talked about how the windows were rattling because there was so much wind
that day.
And then he goes to this fire later on. And because of where he was, right, he pulled up on the leeward side of the building. So the wind is hitting the back. And he didn't even he forgot about that earlier. And then he wasn't getting hit with the wind. So that really drove home the wind-driven. And like you said, making that a part of your size up. And, even we talk about, I remember talking about as, you know, when you drive into the firehouse in the morning, that's when your size up starts, right? Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's when you can kind of see that wind is pushing and going, and, you know, add that to your Rolodex for that day. I mean, I think that he talked about making sure you take like a tactical pause to take everything in, right? So that you can then, you know, make the right decisions.
Yeah. You know, I thought about, I was walking around the lake in my town just the other day, and someone had up, like, on a nautical pole, they had, like, this windsock, you know, and the wind was like howling, you know. And I thought to myself, I said, you know, it might not be a bad idea to put some of these on top of our fire trucks or chief's cars, because it would be a visual reminder as we're pulling up, like, oh, man, why is that thing, like, stiff, you know? Maybe something to think about, you know? Because,
you know,
well, what we did... Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's just a visual
thing,
reminder. That, yeah.
Well, you know, I just saw a conversation. I think it was on Facebook. And the guys had, I think that, you know, Nick Papa from up there in New England, he wrote that ventilation book, and he did a class somewhere, and he told the guys, he's like, hey, look at your flag on the flagpole. If it's standing tall, if it's stiff, it's like a 20-mile-an-hour wind. If it's, you know, half, if it's half up, that's a 10-mile-an-hour wind. So that's a good, that's a good, easy, you know, us for firemen to remember. That was a pretty good nugget there to learn.
You know, something that we learned that we did on the Governor's Island drill with the UL. Now, I wasn't in on those drills. I had already committed to go to South America, so I kind of missed out on that. But, you know, one of the things that we've learned from doing those drills is that we came up with this floor below nozzle, right? So it comes from the floor below. It's got a kind of a bend on it. And we try to introduce water into the airstream. And, it, you know, you look at some of these videos, and it doesn't take much water to really get this fire to get knocked down, like to dissipate, you know, to really, like, really take the starch out of it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that part of our size up needs to be, whether if it's a really windy day, you know, where's going to be our point of entry? Like, do we want to be coming in with the wind at our face? You know, maybe it's better we find another door, come in the other way, and try to have it at our back, you know, because it was a fire we had in the Empire State Building. I want to say it was, gosh, it had to be before 1991, because I was still in 17 truck. And I remember I was sitting outside the police station. There's a subway there waiting for my wife, and I'm looking. I could see the Empire State Building, and I saw this fire. They must have sent 4 or 5 engine companies in, one after the other, trying to knock this out. And someone had the idea that he went down another hallway and came down and flanked it, and was literally standing next to the room that was on fire as his blowtorching out. And, you know, then he just radioed and said, listen, let's bring the line over here. And they just were able to flank it, you know. So maybe this is something that we need to think about, you know, when we get a wind advisory. You know, do we want to go in that front door? Maybe it's better off that we find maybe the side door or even the rear door. I mean, if it's that much wind.
Yeah. No, I think that just keeps leading more credence, right, to us making sure we're doing like a 360, or we're getting views of all sides of the building. You know, that's, we were lucky in D.C. because we were on top of each other with companies, so we had a company in the rear pretty quick. You know, so we had a good view or a good building intelligence on what was going on.
Yeah. You know what I want to do, Tony, real quick? I forgot to do this. I want to give our phone number if anyone wants to call in. I don't know if anyone's listening to us live, but it's the number for calling is 760-454-8852. If you'd like to call us and give us some thoughts, I'd be very happy to take your call. So what works very well for us, we have, you know, we have a five-person truck company. We have four firefighters on our engines, not including the officer. One of our firefighters is called the outside vent firefighter, right? His job is to kind of go around the rear and get a size up and see what's happening. And then we have a roof firefighter who goes up to the roof and gets some eyes on the top of the building. So one of the things, especially in a taller building, is that we'll ask the roof firefighter to replicate what's happening on the fire floor. So he or she will go up to the floor above the direct fire department and would open the door and open a window and report down to command, say, hey, listen, we got a serious wind condition up here, you know, and transmit that to the first two engine and truck company, you know, to advise them that, you know, hey, listen, we got a serious wind condition here. And, just as a side note. Yeah. That's in a fireproof building.
You said he has to go replicate it?
Yeah, so it's in a fireproof building, right? And at the same time, too, we've also used that firefighter to give directions, like the layout of the apartment to the firefighters in the fire apartment. Like, hey, listen, the two bedrooms are in the rear or whatever. But so what he'll do is he'll try to replicate, or he or she, I should say, will open a window and then open a door and then check in to see what kind of conditions are, you know, would be encountered on the fire floor.
Wow. That's good stuff.
That's in a fireproof building, though. Fireproof, you know. I mean, doing that in a non-fireproof, in a Type 3 or a Type 5 may not work, you know, on the floor above. But, you know, in a multiple dwelling Type 1, that's a very good way to replicate the conditions on a fire floor. And it's all about door control, like controlling the stairwell doors. You know, we're very good at determining one stairway as attack and the other one is evacuation. You know, I was just out in Chicago 2 weeks ago, and I happened to stumble across a fire with one of the guys out there. When, I showed up, it was a high-rise. It was a 15-story fireproof Type 1. And I was listening to the radio. The guy I was with, Tim Ulk, had the department radio. And I heard them, and they said, you know, okay, stairway A is the attack stairway, you know, stairway B is the evacuation stair. But we also have to make sure that we control that door on the fire floor, especially the evacuation stair. We don't want to keep that door open. And with the attack stair, we have to be very careful about drawing the fire to us. But sometimes we have no choice because that's the way we're gonna stretch our line, right?
So yeah.
But that's more specific to fireproof buildings, you know.
So tell me about the curtain. You guys still use a lot. Is there a lot of use of the curtain still?
Yes, we do use the fire curtain. You know, the chief has the option to put into place the curtain. Or we have what we call the blanket. The blanket is a little bigger. That's carried by the squads and the rescues, I believe. But the truck companies carry the KO curtain. And that came about, there was two firefighters, Patty Kilduff and Tommy Oswald from 19 Truck. And we had this fire, and I mutualed off that day. I was supposed to be working, and I wound up mutualing off. We had a fire on the top floor on Park Avenue and 159th Street. It's a big, big, tall project building. Anyway, it was one of those jobs where there was like engine companies where they're just getting burnt and then they relieve them and burnt and relieve them. It was the same fire where Mickey Convoy used the roof rope to get a woman that was trapped. And what had happened at that fire was that someone opened the door on the opposite side of the hallway on the fire floor. So what happened was the wind whipped through the open door down the hallway and, you know, into the fire, you know, what was it now? The wind came out the fire apartment into the hallway and down the hallway towards that open door. That's what had happened. So, you know, we always talk about when we're operating on the fire floor that we want to make sure that we don't open doors on the opposite side, right? If you have like Vandalia Avenue, right? That was on the let's say the south side, that apartment, right? If someone had opened a door on the north side, the wind would whip through that apartment and go towards that open door. So we want to make sure that we control those doors. On the other side, like apartment doors, we don't want to open them at all. But the curtain is supposed to be deployed from the floor above, and it's supposed to stop that wind. And that's where they learned that, was that that fire. 19 truck was probably second due with that fire. And that's how they came up with that curtain. And now it's pretty commonplace for us to deploy that curtain at a high rise. I'm thinking, though, too, now, Tony, that why can't we use it in buildings other than high-rises? If we're going to have wind problems in other types of buildings, maybe we should start thinking about wind control devices, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think, have you seen the door curtain, the small one that...
Yes.
Right from Germany came up with. I mean, that's kind of that could help with that. If you have to go into the front door, right? I mean, I think that we have the option of making an attack from the windward side. You know, I mean, even if it means throwing some water in from the outside to get a knock on it. I mean, like you said, man, a little bit of water does a lot of good for us. That if you can size that up ahead of time, you know, throw some water in there and cool it off. That may help you make that attack from the front door if that's where you want to go in.
Yeah. Something I came up with, I was out in the Chicago area 2 weeks ago. I was working with the department up there called Highland Park. And they have this very, very... unique situation, which I don't get really rattled very easily, but this rattled me. It was a 6-story wood frame building loaded with trusses. And it's in the form of an L. And I was just like, I'm looking at this building, and I did a walkthrough, and I'm looking at the standpipes, and I'm thinking to myself, like, what in God's name were they thinking when they built this thing? You know, because...
Yeah.
You know, it's all firefighting in taller buildings, right? It's all about door control, right? So you kind of want to get out of that stairway and get to the apartment door, right? If you could get to that apartment door and control it, now it's game on. Now you could stretch the hose dry and charge it at the door, and then you can make your attack. If you can get the bedroom door, that's even better, right? But now you're talking about a building that has a cock loft or a truss loft on every floor. So now, let's just say worst case scenario, the fire gets up into that truss loft and you have control of the door and you're thinking like, okay, well, I got control of the door and now the fire is over your head in this truss loft.
Very
unnerving, man. I was really trying to wrap my head around like, what do we do here? You know? Like, I don't know. What would be your thoughts?
I mean, fortunately, I think that those are pretty modern buildings, and I'm thinking that they're building them with some fire protection in them that's going to help. It's going to help with that life hazard. Now, it's still going to be tough to put the fire out, but hopefully, right, the sprinklers have activated and the residents can get out, and then we can go in and be a little bit more deliberate in our fire attack. But, no, you're right. I mean, That one is scary, and I think that's what we're seeing, right? I mean, I know I was in before I got promoted to battalion chief, I was downtown by the White House, and a lot of that new construction has got so many void spaces now, and even some of the fire, I wouldn't say fireproof, but a better type two kind of stuff has better construction and has fire protection in it, but there's lots of void spaces. So the fires aren't really big, but you're chasing them around, it seems like, more now than we were before.
Yeah, so that would be my concern, though. Like, are the void spaces sprinkled?
Yeah.
They're probably not. So now the sprinklers are, like, on the ceiling level, and now you have this void space. Like, we have a lot of buildings in the Bronx that were vacant when I was, when I was a young firefighter. And then, like, in the mid-90s, they started renovating them.
Right.
And, now we're stuck with all these voids. And what happens is, invariably, like there's one particular void. It's in the bathrooms, right? And actually, the champ, I was doing the remote tactical training. You know, we did a vacant building. We did a rehab building, I should say. And there's a void that's in the bathroom behind the medicine cabinet. And it's almost like a little room. And it goes from the cellar or the basement up to the cockwalk where they run all their pipes and electric and all that stuff. And there's all these voids where they run all this, like they use them for raceways. We actually found one void that was the size of a closet. So those voids are generally not sprinkled. And what I try to preach or talk about is that we're seeing more and more in America, like you'll take an old movie theater or an old church or whatever, and like even like in the Bronx, we have an old factory, an old warehouse, and now it's apartment buildings, right? And so invariably with the sheetrock, they have all these voids, right? Like, it's just because the way they build the apartments, they just build like a movie set almost. Like, think about like a movie theater, like a movie lot, like a set. You ever see like how they build rooms within like a space, you know? Well, that's really what we have now. We have like we have an apartment that's in an old warehouse space with all these voids because, you know, you might have like a 200 by 200 area. And, you know, they might throw 10 apartments in there. And you have this void space above you. So what I worry about is firefighters going in, like, and now all of a sudden the fire is everywhere, you know?
Well,
I think
we're talking about void space fires, and somebody might have set me up. But, like, one of my best nights was we had a fire. It was a four-story apartment building, and pretty new, but it looked like it was like it had some age to it from the outside, right? But as time went on that night, I could figure out that it was pretty new. So we went there for smoke coming from the roof, and we get inside, and there was some passersby said they saw smoke and sparks coming from the chimney. So the roof team goes up there. They don't see anything. We go inside. We got into a couple of apartments. We didn't get into all of them. We got into a couple of them. We couldn't find anything. We didn't smell anything. We didn't see anything. So it's like, we're not going to, it's one of those ones where we're not going to bust down every door because indications are, there was a fireplace. One of the residents that we did get into had a fire in their fireplace and everything was fine. So it's like, all right, well, it must have just been something they saw while they were walking by. So we leave. Well, we go back. It was like 2 hours later, maybe. And now you could smell wood burning. You could smell wood burning, and you had a haze on upper floors. So we got into one apartment we couldn't get into. We broke the door down. We get inside. And now there was, like, smoke coming from one of these doors that we opened up happened to be an elevator, right? It was a they had an elevator that served from the first floor to the fourth floor, but there was access in this one apartment that we got into. Well, we opened that up. There's no fire in there. So somebody stepped back, and they felt like warmth around this part of the – I think it was the fireplace and the second floor that was the empty apartment, right? So I got my – turned my thermal imaging camera. I go over, and there's heat. I mean, heavy heat in this chase. What they had was fireplaces on all four floors, and all the fire chimneys tied into this big chase, right? So you got one fireplace on the first floor, two chases on the second, three, and so on as it went up. This chase was easily, 4 feet deep by 6 foot wide, and it went from the first floor to the roof. And, again, the second time we went back, now we opened up and found active fire inside there. It was early in that, so it wasn't, it hadn't come out of that yet. But, yeah, I mean, that could be, again, I mean, I'm thinking we left there with that fire burning earlier, and now, fortunately for us, we got back. They called us back. The fire alarm's going off now. We smell it. Before, any residents got hurt by that. And then, we were able to find that. Now, again, we went back a third time because of bad overhaul by me and company. But that's another story. So, like I said, probably set up. If anybody is listening to this that worked with me, they'll be like, oh, yeah, we remember that one. It was bad. It was a bad thing, but it was definitely void space fires, and again, a new construction that we're not getting a lot of fires in, but now we're getting these more difficult fires. I think
that happened to me one time. It was not a shining moment, and I knew I was responsible. We went to this private dwelling. I was working in the squad, I go into the bathroom and I'm like. I'm opening up and I feel the wall and I can feel the tile and the tile is hot, but I'm like, it's probably just hot because, the room was just like on fire, And, I told the lieutenant, I'm like, yeah, it's all good. And then we get back and we go back to the firehouse and about like a half hour later, it's like 10:75. And I knew it as soon as I saw the ticket. I'm like, oh man. I knew exactly what happened. I just was lazy. It was just, I don't know. Boys are tough. I had one. I tell you, one of my rules of thumb. The first question I ask when I get on scene, when I say, we have an odor of smoke. The first question I ask is, what does it smell like? I'll be very specific. Like, does it smell electric? Does it smell like rubbish? Does it smell like food on the stove? Is it plastic?
Yeah.
If I hear the officer tell me, yeah, Chief, I got a little bit of a wood smell, we're not going anywhere. Get your pajamas, man. We're there for the duration because we're not going nowhere.
Right.
So I had one night, and I know the buildings, right? Because I know they're renovated. I remember when they were vacant. So I remember when they were being renovated. I know how they build these things. They have drop ceilings on every floor, and they boxed out everything, So we get an odor of smoke in this five-story, And I'm getting reports. The lieutenant goes up to the fourth and the fifth floors, and he's like, yeah, Chief. He's like, I just smell a little bit something, but it's dissipating, I said, okay, well, I need you to find out where it's coming from. So then another 10 minutes go by, and, same thing. He says, Chief, I recommend that we just give up an odor of smoke, dissipated. I'm like,
yeah.
No, so I grabbed the second truck. I said, do me a favor, truck two, go up and just help them out. And now we're there another 10 minutes, and we're still looking for this thing. So now I'm like, I'm not leaving because I know it's wood. So I go into the lobby, and I'm standing there, and I see this guy come out of his apartment, and he's like, hey, Chief. He goes, this effing building, I'm at my wit's end. He says, I'm getting out of here. He says, the electricity in this building, my lights have been going on and off all day. I'm like, oh, really?
I said, what appointment? Where's your appointment? He says, yeah, I'm in here. I said, do you mind if I just go in there for a second? So I walk into his living room, and then I go over, for some reason, I don't know what drew me to this wall. I went over to this wall in the bedroom, and I put my hands on it, and I was like, it was red hot. So I'm like,
yeah.
I called the truck company. I said, do me a favor, come down here to the first floor. They opened it up. Sure enough, man, it was off to the races, you know? So that's what's happening now with the – I have my own theory on how this is happening. Like, I believe – this is what I believe. Because apartments now have big screen TVs. They have computers. They have all kinds of electric whatever. And I think the BX is running through the walls. It's sitting on these wood beams.
Yeah.
And they're heating them up to an extent where it's like paralysis sets in, which lowers the ignition point of this wood. And then there's more insulation, so these things smolder for days sometimes, you know, until they just break out. Like, we had a job I went to, I wound up going on like on the third alarm. And the residents called around 1800, around the change of tours. They called the super. And the super came up and he's like, yeah, he said, nah, there's no problems here, right? So then they called the fire department around, I guess around 11 o'clock at night at like, you know, 2300 hours. And they could smell it, just like I was talking to the truck company because it's the same house where I was the captain. And they told me they could smell it faintly, you know. And then they would, you know, like they were just kind of looking around and nothing was shown. And I don't know, I'm kind of more of the mindset now that if it's that dire, like you might have to throw a hook up into the ceiling. Either that or go up on a roof and do something. But you're going to have to look into that cockroach space. Well, sure enough, I think they were about to take up. And someone saw like a shoot of flame come out of the light fixture. And then sure enough, they opened it up. The whole cockwolf was gone, right? So, man, I tell you something.
Yeah.
I think I could see it happening more and more now with the increase in lightweight construction with the truss lofts, with the, like, go to any small town, like, you know, like in Westchester. Like, they have a movie theater that is condos now. You know, they have the old church that they turned into a house. What do you think they do with all these voids? They definitely, just for heating, they drop the ceilings down, you know? And, you know, it's all about money, right? So, anyway.
Yeah, but it definitely is making us tougher, and we're not getting sprinklers in those spaces. So,
no.
And you know, I think a lot of guys are trying to rely on that thermal imaging camera, too, right, as opposed to... Put your hand up there. Put your, put a hole in the thing, right? Yeah, I hope that this is getting out to them that, you know, look, it's a great tool, but it's just a tool.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because, you know, we didn't have thermal cameras when I came on the job. I didn't use one until like I was 12 years into the job. I remember Rescue One had one. It was the size of like a small TV, but I could see, I could definitely see firefighters now. They'll go into a room, put the camera up to the ceiling and say, well, we got nothing here, you know, but they don't realize is that you have like the sheetrock, then you have like insulation and it's going to block the heat. Like you have to, like you said, you have to either go like touch it. Well, even with the wall.
Yeah.
You know what I noticed, too, with the lightweight? I noticed this at I was at a fire a few years ago. And I don't really use the thermal imaging camera that much, but I for some reason, I brought it with me. It was the lightweight. And the chief was getting very concerned. And I came in as, like, the all-hands chief, right? And he was about to, like, just pull everybody out. I was like, Tommy, I said, just give me a minute. Let me go up there and just see what's going on. So I went up there. And, like, the fire had already burned through, like, the floor. It, like, burned downwards, right? And there's, like, these joist hangers and it's lightweight, and I could see the charring and everything, right? And so I went up, and I reduced every – like, I pulled out, like, two companies. And I just left the nozzle, the backup, and the officer. in the fire room. And I had everyone else back out down the stairs. But what I noticed is that the room was still very hot, and I had my camera. And I started looking at the wall, and those metal studs were retaining the heat, and that's what was showing up on my camera. Have you ever had anything like that happen before? Like, that was, like, new to me.
Yeah, you mean like it was still hot, but it wasn't burning. It was just still like conduction, and it was cooling off, but it was still hot. Yeah, I mean, they're really good. They're really good at some of these things, right? They do help you, you know, as part of the puzzle, as trying to find what's going on, but then you got to just confirm, you know? And I don't think that, you know, guys understand that the temperature thing, you know, isn't very reliable either, you know? So, I like him. I got to really use it a lot. I was on a rescue company for like 6 years, and everybody on it had one. So we got a lot of time with them. The truck companies, we all had one, you know, the officer did or whoever carried it. But I got a lot of work with them. And, you know, there definitely was times where, you know, it could lead you down the wrong path. But as long as you realize that it was a tool and that it wasn't going to be, it was to enhance your skills, not to replace any skills. So, I think that they're needed, right? They're now they're so affordable that everybody can have one. But, I mean, everybody needs to train, too. That's a problem.
And you that's need a great comment.
Real-world experience.
Yeah, that's a great comment that you said, that it's there to enhance our skills, not to replace. And I think firefighters have to understand that, especially the newer generation, right? Because when I came on a job, we didn't have them. And, I just never got good at it. I never – and then I was a lieutenant and a captain in the engine, and the engines didn't have them. So I just never got good at it. And then I got to use it now as a chief. And I use it for, like, I'll take it with me, especially if I'm not the incident commander. If I'm going as, like, the what we call the operations chief or the old hand chief.
Yeah.
And I use it for just to keep an eye on, you know, firefighters on the fire ground, on the fire floor. But I tell you what, I had a job about 2 weeks ago. It was on YouTube, actually. It was a fourth alarm in Queens. And I wound up going to the rear, right? Because, we had, like, basically, in essence, three buildings exposed. Like, the fire building was, like, two buildings. It was an auto parts store. But then the third building on the Bravo side was a daycare center. It was like 100 by 100. It was a big building, you know. And anyway, I was like doing my darndest. I did not want to lose this third building. So I went around the back, and it was like you really couldn't even – outside, you really needed a mask, like outside, you know. But I'm supervising, and I had my camera with me. And I was really concerned about the Charlie wall, because already the Delta wall had already collapsed partially. And I was very, very concerned about that Charlie wall, you know. And, you know, what I did was I took that camera, and I was able to see everything. I saw where the firefighters were. I could see where the fire was coming out the windows, you know. And what I had to do, though, Tony, at some point, I actually I got on the radio and I said, you know, I called for safety. And I asked them, I said, do me a favor, come back to the Charlie side, to the rear yard. Because I needed them to watch my back while I was trying to kind of work in this daycare center. Like, I couldn't do both, you know what I'm saying? Like, I couldn't stand there and watch the guys and make sure that they weren't in danger, and at the same time try to keep the fire out of the explosion. So, but that camera, I have to tell you, that was really one of the few times in my career where I could say to myself, man, that camera saved my ass. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it really did, because I couldn't see anything back there. I'm telling you, man, I was just like in a smoke out, you know? And wow, you know,
yeah,
that was very grateful to have. So you obviously have a lot more experience with thermal image cameras than I do, because I have very minimal experience with the camera.
Well, I mean, that's the thing too, right? Just like every other tool, you can't get good at it unless you use it a lot, right? I mean, experience comes with experience. So we got to go to, we need more fires that we can go to use them.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a fire one time. I was working in 19 truck, and I had the camera, and I said to myself, I'm going to use it. It was a church, you know. I said, you know what? I'm going to use it, you know, and I'm in there. And like, first of all, I got so distracted with the thing because all I could do was look at the camera, and I lost all my other senses. Like, I'm usually good at, like, you know, feeling, like, the heat, the sound, you know, like, all that stuff. I'm really good at, like, compensating because I can't see. So now I have the camera, and it turned out one of the lieutenants came over. He's like, hey, listen, you dope. The fire's right there. You're looking at it. It was like this doorway that was white, and I had no idea that that meant that was a fire. You know, like,
yeah.
I'm like, ladder, one night I can't find the fire. You know, it's like, he came over, he looked at the camera. He's like, it's right there, stupid. You know, I said, oh, I put it down after that. I was like, you know what? I forget it. I said, I can't use this thing. So,
I got called out after a fire. I got hurt on. We were first new truck on this. It was 11-story apartment building. Fire was on the second floor. And we pull up, and I know where the fire was, right? I could tell where it was. And I didn't need the camera. Plus, the camera we were using then, I don't know if you've ever seen, like, a carpet kicker. I mean, this thing was huge, right? It was a real, it was an
right.
anchor. Anyways, the excuses are bad, but I didn't take the camera with me. So, wouldn't you know that as we're searching around, I thought I found an apartment door, what actually turned out to be the open elevator shaft. So
cool.
In my decision to go, I ended up falling like 35 feet. Well,
oh wow!
I'm in the elevator shaft, and the rescue officer who was on the fire floor. He came over, right? He came over when my barman, my hook and axe guy, he called in like a priority message. And Klinger, the lieutenant from the rescue, came over, and he used his camera. He's like, oh, he's right there. You know, he could see plainly the door, and then, of course, he could see me down in the elevator, right? So that came out in like the after-action report. So, you know, they're like, Lieutenant Carroll didn't bring his camera in, and Lieutenant Klinger had this. So now I'm like, I'm taking one everywhere I go from now on, you know? So,
yeah.
I mean, it was, and, you know, I'm sure if I had had it, it would have been able to outline that this was not an apartment and this was, you know, not the door you want to go in. Fortunately, it worked out. I didn't die. I got a little broken bones, but that was about it.
Yeah, I really, I guess my hat's off to the younger generation because they're going to be really good at the camera. I mean, I'm just not good at it. I bring it when I'm the ops chief or the all hands chief, and
yeah,
I just use it basically for. Just to watch, you know, to watch the firefighters on the fire floor. I don't really know how to use it tactically. I was thinking about maybe in the future bringing it, if I'm the IC, like, and someone told me, like, you could scan the outside of the building and you might be able to pick up which window. Like, if the windows are closed in the winter, you might be able to pick up a heat signature. But
I mean, you could definitely can, right? It depends on how good the windows are, definitely, right? And you know, how far away the fire is, you definitely can. It definitely helps with that, especially if you're the first one there. It could definitely help with, you know, determining where you're going to start your attack or where you're going to go. You know, go first.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really good.
Yeah,
they've made them so accessible now.
Yeah, I tell you one thing. I can't really stress enough about how important it is to locate the fire. So, because I see sometimes things can go really sideways when you start working and like you think like the fire is here, and meanwhile it's in the other wing or it's in the other building or whatever. And or worst case scenario is like I've seen this too, is like you stretch above the fire. Like, you know, let's say people call. Like this happened one time. We had this fire. I was in the squad. And it came in as a fire on the second floor, right? But it was a rehab. It turned out that the fire was actually in the first floor apartment. And what had happened was it got up in that little cock loft space, that mini cock loft that was in the floors. And I could see this now happening with truss lofts, right? So, you know, you really have to, like, just before you commit that line, like, just hold on. You know what I mean? Like, get enough to stretch to get to the floor above. But let's make sure that we're not going above the fire, because what happened was the first engine went up above, and, you know, it's like a basement fire, right? When you have that high heat, you have a lot of smoke, but you have, like, really no visible fire. You know, and it kind of goes back to this building I was talking about in Chicago, right? I told the guys, I said when I was there, I said I could see someone from the fourth floor calling and saying, "Hey, there's a fire in my apartment," or whatever, and they go up to the fourth floor, commit the line to the fourth floor, and it's really in the truss loft on the third floor, right? I could see that happening. I could see that happening in any lightweight building. So, you know, it's incumbent upon, I guess, the first officer, or I don't know how departments work, but like for us, it would be the truck company. Maybe in D.C. it would be the same, but someone has to say, "Yes, I have eyes on the fire. It's here." And you can't guess. You know what I mean? Like if you guess, we could talk all night about how things go sideways, you know, but the worst one I've ever seen, and every one of us would have made the same decision. There was a fire in the throat of this big apartment house, and they just assumed it was on the Bravo side. What happened when they renovated the building, they put the entrance on the Delta side. So even though it looked like it was actually in the Bravo side of the building, but the door was on the Delta side, you know? So, you know, they're like miles away from the fire now, you know? So,
yeah,
that's the one.
I'm sure you've been caught. I know I've been caught where you get there and there's smoke coming out from around the eaves, you know, and you're thinking, oh, it must be a top floor fire, and then it's you know, and then it's like a basement or it's a first floor fire, and the smoke is just coming out of the around the eaves or around you know, a window on the. And you get caught, and you get to go above it. I mean, and those are, bad situations. We know how bad the basements are if you're above a basement. Well, the same thing if you're on the second floor and a fire's on the first floor. I mean, I just think that we have to be so deliberate in our efforts to make sure that we're not going above and we're using the best entrance, the most, you know, advantageous and not putting us in a bad spot. Kind of goes back to the wind-driven thing, right? I mean, if you can take a little extra time to find a better way in.
Yeah. Well, this happened to me, and I can tell you, this ties in to knowing your buildings, right? So I'm a Bronx guy my whole career, and I'm working in Queens now. Like one of my first tours, I'm acting battalion chief, right? It's like 20 years ago. And I'm just used to tenements straight up. And I don't know really much about private dwellings. And I think this is now where construction comes in really important, right? Because if you know that the buildings in your district are balloon frame, then now you start thinking like, okay, balloon frame. Because, and you gotta also forget about what the people say. Like when they call in, they say, "Hey, there's a fire on the second floor," you know? So I get this call for a fire. This is what they said. Fire on the second floor, right? So now in my mind, I'm already thinking like, okay, we got a fire on the second floor. So I pull up. I'm there by myself. There's no engine. There's no truck. There's nothing. Just me by myself. And I see the smoke pouring out the window on the second floor. I gave a signal. All right, 1075, working fire, second floor, private dwelling. I go in now because there's no one around. I throw my stuff on. I go in, and the door to the basement is open, and I get hit with a blast of heat from the basement. I'm like, oh, no, man. Uh-oh. You know, like, what's going on here, you know? So, yeah, I mean, that's just another component of size up, man, knowing construction. Because knowing construction, yep, you're going to know how the buildings are going to react and how fire is going to behave in that type of building, right? So,
no,
well, anyway.
I agree. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's more than just, like, worrying about it falling down. It's also worrying about, you know, how it can travel, right? I think that we get wrapped up around
how we can travel, yeah.
Yeah, about the construction, where for you know, for like 10 minutes operating, 20 minutes operating. But it's also important to know,
right,
you know, how the fire can travel through that whole place.
Exactly. So I tell you what, Tony, I think we're an hour into this now, and I don't want to beat these people to death, these guys or gals or whoever's listening to us. So I'll say to be continued. We could talk all night about anything, but to be continued. So anyway, Tony, I want to thank you for joining us. I hope that you will join us again in the future.
Yes, sir.
And with that, I'm exhausted. My head's bouncing off the table here. So we will be in touch, though. Are you going to be out at FDIC?
Yes, I'll be there. I got a class on Thursday. First thing in the morning, which, by the way, April 27th is my birthday, so
wow,
we can go celebrate that,
okay.
And then I can't do too much because my class is the day after at 8:30 in the morning.
Okay.
So if you're out there and you want to come talk about May Day Monday, if you want to talk about firefighter survival, I'll be doing a class there and would love to have you as part of my audience.
Oh, I'd love to be there. I'll definitely look for it. And I am doing the keynote on the 26th, which is Wednesday. And then I think I don't know when my class is. I think it's Thursday too, but I think it's in the afternoon. And my class, I'm going to do something. This is something that I talked about with Bobby too. It's going to be more of a kind of a 37 years of life in the Bronx. That's how I could describe it. So.
Wow.
Gonna have some teaching points, but it's gonna be more like I have about 15 fires I want to talk about, so that's what that's gonna be about. I wish I knew what day it was. I'm embarrassed that I don't remember the day. I'm pretty sure it's Thursday. I'm just not sure what time it is. So anyway, Tony, I want to thank you.
Sounds good.
And we're gonna wrap it up, and I will see you out at FDIC on whenever you get there. I'm gonna be there on Sunday, so I'll see you out there. Okay.
Yes, sir, man. Thanks a lot for having me, and I'll see you in Indy.
Thanks, Tony. Take care. Bye-bye. Go. Bye. All right. That was cool. That was Tony Carroll from D.C., who's now in Virginia. Anyway, look for my class. I wish I knew when it was. It's going to be something about the real stories from the FDNY. Just look for Danny Sheridan. I think it's on Thursday, and my keynote is on Wednesday. And if you see me out in FDIC, please come up and say hello. I'd like to say hello. I'd like to see you and talk about whatever you need to talk about. All right? Without further ado, I'm going to take off. Good night.